There's something really strange that happens when you know you're being watched. When you can literally feel someone's eyes on you or feel the burning weight of their expectations, it becomes difficult to act. Or rather, it becomes more difficult to act in a way that feels natural or normal. Or it becomes more difficult to act in a way that feels natural or normal to you. It's like when you're walking out of the grocery store but haven't bought anything. and you're scared someone will think you're stealing, and suddenly you have an awareness of every camera capturing your movements and every employee who might be watching you with suspicion. And it doesn't matter that you haven't actually done anything wrong, only that someone is watching, and suddenly you've forgotten how to walk, you're hyper aware of every step, you're consumed by the thought that you need to look innocent. But how do you look innocent? And suddenly, you've gone from being totally normal to walking with strangely small steps and looking around with wild eyes and taking unusually long, intense breaths. And if you didn't look suspicious before, you probably do now. And your body has betrayed you because suddenly you have all of these markers of someone who has some great evil within them to hide. Even though your only sin is that you came to the grocery store for oat milk and they didn't have any, so now you need to leave. That feeling of being watched is like its own small form of punishment, because you can feel your mind bending to the will of those around you as you almost like lose control and seem to surrender your own free will so you can act in accordance to the perceived expectations of other people. That is power. That is diffuse power, and it's always operating in society. There are moments where you might not even notice what's happening, and others where it suddenly feels so concentrated that it literally is throwing you off balance.
I'm in danger!
One of my favorite topics to study in university was nonviolent means of social control, and how who you are is created by all the small ways that power dents and molds you throughout your life, and how the constant threat of surveillance keeps you in check and teaches you how to self-regulate and how to be in the world and how to be in society. One of my favorite things to think about now is what it means to take that power back by smoothing out the dents that society has formed in our person, learning how to hold on to the things that help us be in good relationship with one another while letting go of the things that prevent us from being in good relationship with ourselves. You're listening to Her Anthology, a publication dedicated to personal and social inquiry. Find my writing and stickers at heranthology.com. That's HERANTHOLOGIE.com. Anyways, back to the show. Today, we're talking about you. Like I was saying, the practice of surveillance is a really effective form of social control, knowing that someone is watching, gathering information, waiting in the wings to punish you for falling out of line. All of that is an excellent motivator to get people to conform. I talked about the example in the grocery store. I think another great example is the way, like, a lot of people will try to separate their personal and their professional lives on social media, because you're just likely to act different online, knowing that your boss or prospective employers are watching and judging the things that you're posting on Instagram or posting on LinkedIn. I think it's like really funny, people talk about like how you have like your identity on like your regular Instagram and then like a totally different identity on LinkedIn, because that's more geared towards employers, and you know that you have a different audience and you're acting differently according to the audience that you perceive to be watching you. Years ago, while I was studying social control, one of the things that really drew me in was this hypothetical prison called the Panopticon that, without cameras, could create the sense that you were always being watched. Now, keep in mind, when the Panopticon and everything was thought up, it's like a theoretical prison that was thought up by this guy named Jeremy Bentham and then later taken on by Foucault. But keep in mind that this was like way, way back in the day. So, I mean, I'm pretty sure like during the time that Jeremy Bentham thought this up, this was like the 1700s or something. So like there weren't any cameras. So just kind of like keep that in mind. Anyways, like the idea here is that in a regular prison, obviously you have a criminal population. So there is the assumption that, you know, people aren't always gonna be on their best behavior. And in an ordinary prison, you'd need obviously multiple security guards patrolling the halls, but the prisoners would always be able to tell when they were being watched, Maybe they would hear footsteps or see a light approaching or see the guard stand. Ambiance by Yugi. Got something to say? Got something to say? What's that? You heard it here, folks. Anyways, yeah, you need multiple security guards that are kind of like walking through the halls, but they'd always know when they needed to be on their best behavior because you'd be able to hear footsteps or maybe see a light approaching or see the guard like physically standing in front of their cell. So they would know when to behave and when they might be able to get away with stepping a little bit out of line. But in the Panopticon, instead of being a typical building that's built with four walls, the idea was that the prison would be circular, but in the middle of the prison would be a singular watchtower. So in theory, the guard in the watchtower could be watching you at any time, and you'd never know. The prisoners would always feel like they're being watched without ever being able to see if they're actually being observed. And the guard in the middle in the watchtower theoretically would be able to see everything without ever being seen themselves. Instead of exerting physical power by being a physical presence patrolling the halls or like a physical presence exerting like physical violence, the idea here is to get power to exercise through someone's mind. Just the idea of being watched should be enough to get them to keep themselves in check. So instead of having the mindset that you just need to wait for the right moment to raise hell, the hope was that the prisoners would switch to a mindset that there is never a right moment. Because like, think about this thought process. Like, I know that if the guard catches me, I'm going to be punished. So to avoid punishment, I need to make sure that when I'm being watched, I'm behaving the way the guard expects me to behave. But since I never know when I'm being watched, I always need to behave in the way that the guard expects me to behave. So from there doesn't actually need to be any physical punishment. And theoretically, you could take the guard out of the watchtower. It doesn't matter. There doesn't need to actually be a physical presence there at all. It's just the idea that power is there, the idea that power is watching you, just a threat of observation. So from there, from discussions of the Panopticon, we would like spring into like all of these like various theories and analogies about the creation of a surveillance state with cameras everywhere and your data being collected and stored God knows where for God knows what, and the total erosion of privacy, and also like milder associations about how society generally is always employing these diffuse forms of power that infiltrate our minds, are imprinted on our bodies, and influence us to conduct ourselves in certain ways. And this isn't like some crazy theory that I'm trying to posit about mind control, but it's just like a very plain observation about how society functions. If you think about cultural norms or social values or laws, if you think about those things as like symbolically the person in the watchtower, of course it is a little different. So give me like some room here, but like, there doesn't need to be someone there every second of the day patrolling the streets, reminding you to follow social customs or to obey laws, because we've been conditioned enough to have internalized them. So the power plays out in our minds, even with no one there to enforce them. Side note that there are some places where they literally do have people patrolling the streets, forcing people to abide by customs, but I am speaking to my own specific social context. But anyways, you know, the threat of being seen, just like, oh, I can't be seen doing this, you know, of being judged, of being watched, is sometimes enough to get you to stop doing something that you might otherwise do in the privacy of your own home if no one were around. Like, after so many times being punished for doing something or shamed for doing something as you're growing up, those lessons become imprinted on your body. So the power of the idea that at any point somebody could call you out for stepping out of line, that shapes your behavior. It shapes the things that you are and aren't willing to engage in. Now, sometimes this is a great thing. Sometimes this is an amazing thing because it creates a society with order where we're able to have and function according to shared expectations. And there are some cultural norms that I think are fantastic, laws that I think are beautiful. Like, it's a great cultural norm that people are aware of, like, body odor, and like, it's a norm to wear deodorant. Like, if you are someone that is like walking around like the place like stinking, like, you're probably gonna get some stares. It's a cultural norm here, like, to try to give people personal space. It's a cultural norm here to, like, be almost like overly kind, like being just like a regular level of kind is like rude almost. It's like you have to open the door for someone who's like 10 steps down the road and like be smiling and always say thank you to the bus driver when you get off. Like, I think there are some cultural norms that create order, some cultural norms that like just create for like a nicer society. Like, sometimes like people will do like wild things on the internet. I don't know, the internet is almost like a lawless place, but like sometimes people will do wild things on the internet, and I'll go to the comments and the comments will be like, we need to bring shame back. I just think that's so funny because, yeah, like, there are some times where, like, genuinely that idea of feeling shamed for doing something odd is beneficial because it keeps people acting normal. But then within that conversation is, like, the, oh, but, like, what is normal and why is it normal and should it be normal or should people be able to step outside of that? And so that's when you get into the part where it's, like, sometimes that feeling of power imprinted on your body and restraining you from acting in certain ways, you know, sometimes it's not so great because it creates sometimes moments in society where people feel unnecessarily suppressed or unnecessarily limited in their self-expression for really no good reason other than the fear of the voices that they've internalized. Like, the thing that the person wants to do isn't necessarily harmful or disorderly, but it's just outside of the norm. And because of the cultural norms, the power of the cultural norms imprinted on their body, they feel like they're unable to do certain things or they feel hesitant about doing certain things, really for no good reason at all.
Namaste, everyone, and welcome.
Thank you for joining us today for our daily practice. Now, before we begin, remember, there are no judgments here.
I started practicing yoga sometime in 2018 after coming into what might best be described as a personal crisis, which maybe we'll get into someday on the podcast, but not today. Since then, I've practiced with varying degrees of dedication over the years. Now, one of the massive critiques of Western culture and its relationship to yoga is that the physical practice of yoga is often divorced from the philosophical aspects of the practice. There's yoga on the mat, which you can think of as like physically going to a yoga class, getting on the mat, bending yourself into various shapes, and like breathing with intention.
Now, everybody put your sit bones on the ground and bring your walk sticks up over your think globe for a pose called Monkey with Shattered Spine.
Then there's also yoga off the mat, which is the ethical practice and the philosophical and spiritual underpinnings that really make yoga what it is, which is in many ways a journey towards yourself. And there really isn't that like distinction. Yoga on the mat, yoga off the mat, like all of it is yoga. It is like one body and they're like various limbs that are tied to it. The reason that I'm talking about this is because one of the ethical teachings in yoga is a niyama called self-study or svadhyaya. Pardon my pronunciation there as it is likely incorrect. But broadly, the yamas and niyamas are ethical or moral guidelines for living. More specifically, yamas are guidelines for how we interact with others and niyamas are guidelines for how we interact with ourselves. Anyways, like I was saying, one of the niyamas is self-study, and captured within that niyama is the concept of becoming your own witness, learning how to pull back and watch yourself as a means to bring you closer to who you are, literally studying yourself, watching yourself, learning yourself, almost as if you were like a third person conducting some sort of like anthropological project, to really sit back and witness the thoughts that are coming up, the emotions that are attached to those thoughts, the beliefs that are attached to those emotions, instead of just going through life without examining who you are and why you are the person that you are, actually taking time to witness your conditioning and to swap out the person who is like theoretically in the watchtower. Usually we live our lives like living under the influence of someone else's perspective or with the understanding that we're being watched by our parents or our boss or our friends, and we're taught to internalize our expectations and bend our behavior according to their will. Self-study is almost a practice of flipping that on its head and learning how to hear your own voice, how to put yourself in the watchtower and live under your own influence so that other people don't have unexamined power over you, and so that the person who is watching you and the person you're conforming to isn't a voice seeking to punish you or to shame you, but is just seeking to know you, watching for you to unfold and become who you really are. Sometimes I'll take it further and I'll try to study myself from the perspective of who I hope to be in the future. So I'll imagine myself at the end of my life. Like, I don't know if this is like depressing, but I think that it's helpful sometimes to remember that you're gonna die because it just puts everything into perspective. But I'll imagine myself like at the end of my life being like a soft old woman who's like living in the forest, among her animals, in her cottage, who's already accomplished and doesn't feel the need to take life so seriously, who feels self-assured, who feels comfortable moving slowly. And under her gaze, I just feel more calm. I feel more compassionate towards myself. I feel a greater sense of ease. I feel more comfortable moving in a way that feels sustainable. I feel more hopeful in moments where I feel stressed. When I just imagine myself, like when I imagine like the older version of myself looking at the person that I am now, I feel more ownership over my choices. I feel less of a need to be for the sake of other people and more freedom to be for myself. And with that, I feel like more truth and more conviction in my actions. I think that who we are and how we move through the world is always so greatly influenced by who we believe is watching. But the world sometimes can be so loud and so demanding that rarely do we feel permission to take space to listen to our own voice. You aren't only supposed to be living according to other people's standards. You're allowed to create standards for yourself, and you're allowed to live a life under your own influence, and you're allowed to do things that bring you joy. I think that's something that we are often trained to leave behind, and I think, like I said, there are good things and bad things that come of that, depending on what brings you joy. But I think it's important to learn how to hold on to the things that help us be in good relationship with one another while letting go of the things that prevent us from being in good relationship with ourselves. Hey, thanks for listening. If you enjoy my work online, consider reading it in print. My name is Felicia and I produce this podcast and also publish a zine called Her Anthology, where I release semi-regular issues on no particular schedule, but each issue makes space to explore what it means to live a good life. Find my writing at heranthology.com. That's heranthology.com. And again, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.